and welcome to Noise in Brief, the podcast series from PR Week. I'm Siobhan Holt, the news editor of PR Week UK, and your host today. I'm joined by PR Week editor John Harrington and reporter Evie Barrett. Hi to you both.
Hi.
But before we begin today's podcast, I'd like to give a quick plug for some upcoming PR Week conferences. Influencer 360, which examines the latest trends in influencer marketing, takes place in London on the 10th of April. There's also PR 360, PR Week's biggest conference of the year, and that's happening in Brighton on the 8th and 9th of May. Check out the events section of the PR Week website for more info and to book. To begin, we've had a lot of bosses at the big agencies departing their roles in recent weeks. John, you've been looking into this for us. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, well, there's really been a huge number in the last few months and in recent weeks, as you say. So for an article this week, I asked some sort of experienced industry figures why this has been happening, basically. I'm going to stress that they and I, sort of talking in general terms here, not about anyone in particular. I actually delayed publishing the article twice last week after news of some big departures came out. I didn't want people to think it was about one person or one agency specifically. So if you're listening to it and you're one of those people, it's almost certainly not about you. But anyway, so I've got some general points to make here, and then we can discuss some of them. So the first point that these people were making was quite an obvious one, really: the difficult trading conditions in 2023, which have put pressure on agency bosses, leading to sort of, you know, strained relationships, inevitably in some cases, and sort of encouraging departures. The second point was kind of big industry changes going on at the moment. AI, obvious one. Mm-hmm. Other big innovations, services being added. And for good or ill, this might encourage some owners to seek new leadership who they maybe think have more of a background in these areas. Quite a few of the speakers were sort of quite critical of this approach, incidentally, by the owners, but I'll come on to that. Mergers and acquisitions as well. You know, it's changed the complexion of quite a lot of agencies. So this could have encouraged some people to either leave or to join if they think it's more suited to them. So the third point, talk about agency owners, there's quite strong comments from Graham Goodkind at Frank PR. Graham said he thinks the quality of owners has declined. He said he's not sure private equity owners, quote, actually give a shit about the business, its people, or the work it is doing. He said they need to deliver bottom line performance over and over again, and sometimes agency leaders just get in the way a bit. So elsewhere, there was talk of burnout, bosses wanting to get away from the pressures of running an agency, which you can understand, and sort of reassess their lives a bit. And another point was just about kind of cyclical shakeout. You know, you have these sort of patterns where, especially if you've got a particularly difficult period or a period of change or a period of stress, you know, you'll naturally see a sort of churn at the top of businesses. And that's something we see in this industry. So a lot to look at here. But what do you both think? What do you think sort of are some of the main drivers of this trend?
I mean, given that we're now 4 years after the initial COVID lockdown, the timing does seem to make sense. During that period, obviously, people wanted stability in their jobs, given everything else that was going on. But now it feels like we've had a couple of years of more or less normality, which means that people are probably feeling more brave to try something new.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it was Andy West who you interviewed for your piece, the industry consultant, that said it sort of best when he was talking about the departures. He said that he thinks it's a combination of truly personal reasons, a realisation of post-pandemic that there's more to life than running a large firm, and that maybe the self-awareness to accept that there comes a point where the firm needs new thinking and fresh ideas, which would definitely fit with some of the points you raised as well, John.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, maybe looking back on 4 years now since COVID, that there was a lot of work going around. It was maybe a little bit easier to do the work-life balance than it probably is now. Things have definitely, you know, switched back more to how it was. So I think there maybe is the personal element probably does fit in there.
Yeah, I think so. I wonder if there's just quite a lot of disappointment, frankly, from senior people in agencies about how they thought the work-life balance would pan out.
Mm.
I mean, there was probably this sense that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have to go to the office as much, that sort of Zoom calls and working from home would be much, much more common than they... I mean, obviously, they still happen a lot.
Mm.
But this whole kind of back to the office thing, and maybe there's a sense of, you know, a sort of an expected kind of shake-up of how this all works, but actually it feels like it's been rolled back a bit. So that could be a factor. I also think it's a big challenge because, so, I mean, there's a combination of push and pull factors, right, for these things sometimes. Inevitably, there'll be some people who feel that they haven't performed and that, you know, maybe they feel like they're getting pushed out for those reasons. But there's also a sense of, like, people want to try something else.
Mm.
And they might think that, you know, there are other things out there. But this really shows that there's a kind of challenge when it comes to employer branding for agencies. You know, this sense that, as well as attracting people, obviously attracting clients, but attracting employees as well, there's also the challenge of keeping them and making sure that you still appear to be a good place to work and somewhere where there are a lot of exciting challenges and so on. Yeah, this strikes me as a particular challenge now.
Yeah, I think with all the mergers and acquisitions going on, employer branding has kind of come under scrutiny a bit more because obviously, especially with big mergers, you're kind of getting two agencies which maybe had distinct personalities in some people's eyes kind of coming together and being homogenised. And some people are critical of that and think that people want to work for an agency that they know what it stands for and what its personality is like. And perhaps that's less the case now.
I think there's a real challenge as well that things are moving quite quickly, especially, you know, we're writing a lot about AI. Mm. And I think it's constantly a topic of conversation. So I imagine it's even worse if you're a big boss and how you lead that. And if it's an area that maybe you're not an expert in, I could understand people maybe thinking this is just a challenge that I'm not willing to take on.
Yeah, and it might be that some owners think that that's what the sort of agency bosses are like. One of the things that really came out in the piece that I wrote was this sense of how short-sighted that really is. Because actually, conversely, what you do need at a time like this is kind of people who've been there and done it, bought the T-shirt. You know, people who've been through recession, people who've been through a huge amount of technological change affecting the industry. I mean, you think about the social media revolution, you know, Web3 and the metaverse still happening. No end of things that we could point to that have sort of shaken up how the industry works in the past, say, 20, 25 years. So wouldn't you actually want someone who's dealt with those challenges before to be the sort of smart brain to see this one through? So yeah, I do agree with that idea that careful what you wish for. And actually, sometimes it is just that experience that you need more than anything else at this time.
We're going to take a short break now for some messages. Do stay around for more on Nike and why it's been facing a challenging comms crisis.
What's it like to lead a failing business? What do underwear thieving gnomes have to do with CEO pay? And what on earth is resenteeism? I'm Ailish Cronin, and I'm the co-host of Management Today's Leadership Lessons podcast. In weekly episodes, we delve into the world of leadership through interviews with high-profile CEOs, academics, and authors, as well as analysis of the news, trends, and ideas you need to know about. You can find us all on the usual podcast platforms.
We're going to discuss a recent news story now involving sports brand Nike. John, can you tell us a little bit more?
Yes, so you may have seen this. This one kind of exploded back end of last week and over the weekend. Last week, Nike released a version of the England men's football kit featuring a version of the St. George's cross on the collar. Controversially, it seems, the traditional red and white colours were replaced by navy, light blue and purple. Nike said the, quote, playful update aimed to unite and inspire. It was also apparently a nod to the colours of the England team that won the World Cup in 1966. Mm-hmm. So there you go. However, some said it was disrespectful, too old to the flag. Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer waded in and criticised it. There were the inevitable accusations of being woke. Some people linked the colours to the flag representing bisexuality. Others, it's a separate point, but took umbrage at the cost of the new strip, which was up to just under £125 for adults. But then conversely, some pointed out that the flag has featured on the shirt previously, often with different colours and a different form. But you can see what would happen here. You know, it became a really big cultural war debate that we've seen before. And I wrote a piece on this asking a couple of questions. The first one, will this damage Nike, harming its reputation with the FA and, you would have thought, a number of England fans, possibly? Or conversely, will the publicity help the sales? But a second point, which I think is much more interesting for this debate, was, did Nike predict this? Did it do it on purpose? Because actually being at the heart of a cultural war debate can mean huge coverage. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's definitely been the case in this situation. But I'd argue if they did do that, this is a risky strategy. I mean, going back a few years, brands have been doing this for quite a while. I mean, a few years ago, there was the, I don't know if you remember this, the PR tactic of purposely annoying Piers Morgan to get publicity. this was a genuine PR tactic. Certainly after the famous Greg vegan sausage roll launch in 2019 that made him irate. I mean, the thing is, since then, though, I think things have taken a much darker turn. I don't know if you remember the Cadbury's Cream Egg campaign from a few years ago, featured two men kissing. It had some backlash at the time. While you can argue it's good to show inclusion in campaigns like that, and it absolutely is, what it did was bring out homophobic trolls and sort of helped create an uncomfortable environment for people from that community is one of the things that we were hearing at the time. And I think the term here is baiting. You know, was Nike purposely baiting the backlash in some way, kind of whipping it up? And to be clear, I've no evidence that they were. I did ask them by the way, I didn't hear back. So maybe we can take them on their words that it was a genuine aim to unite and inspire. But I do think there's a general warning here, regardless of Nike's intentions, that brands need to be very careful in the era of culture wars not to bait hate. So that was my take, basically. What do you both think about this fury and the biggest lessons for our industry, really?
Just to go back to your Piers Morgan, I don't think it takes much to get response from him. Side note, I'm sure some of those weren't even baited.
Yeah, with Percy Pigs, he got annoyed. He had a thing about vegans for a while. It was vegan Percy Pigs, I think he was...
Did you feel personally vindicated?
I feel attacked, yes. No, I don't, I don't know how to say how little I care about such an attack, but it certainly seemed to do well with some brands getting some publicity off the back of that.
But going back to Nike, I think, personally, I don't think this will impact Nike's reputation. I think the biggest impact for them is going to be the price of that shirt. I think this is a situation that has... going to get a lot of attention currently, but I think in the long term it will die down. I mean, we've had similar incidences where sports brands have had this and they've written it out. A lot of sports brands seem to take the response of not really commenting after a big crisis like this. They sort of keep very quiet and just let it settle. I'm thinking of Adidas when they had their fake press release hack. Last year, they sort of kept very quiet after that and it seemed to go away. And then we've obviously had Nike's a similar shirt incident, which was Mary Earps' replica shirt, which they did a U-turn on again last year. So, and again, that's also settled down slowly. So that's my personal opinion, is that it won't impact Nike's reputation in the long run.
I mean, surely it comes down to what type of brand you are and what you're trying to achieve here. Nike's a slightly odd example, like you say, because they're so big. And if they did do this on purpose and were expecting the outrage, then maybe the predictive result would be that less shirts would sell. But at the end of the day, it's such a huge brand that their entire audience was never going to launch a total boycott. So the stakes perhaps weren't that high. But for most brands where wading into a culture war could seriously impact their reputation, they probably need to think about what the best and worst case scenario of that action would be and to seriously weigh that up, which probably sounds obvious, but some organisations, I imagine, get so hung up on wanting to do the right thing and advocate for causes that they feel strongly about, or perhaps on the flip side, purposely provoking people, that they don't stop to think whether that will do them any favours beyond the initial spike of attention, whether that's good or bad attention, because people don't forget these types of things.
Mm-hmm. Last week was PR Week's PharmaComms conference in London. Thanks to all those who attended the one-day conference. It was a packed day, guys, wasn't it? A panel, discussions and talks. But what stood out to you, Evie, the most?
So I sat in on a talk from Luke Mercier-Willets, who is comms boss at Moderna, and he was reflecting on the comms strategies that were deployed around COVID. He actually admitted that things were quite rushed and that in trying to focus on giving regular updates, there was probably some empathy lost along the way. He also questioned whether the pharma industry can actually do much in terms of tackling dis and misinformation, making the point that if Moderna or Pfizer goes out and tells people to get vaccinated, it's not really likely to have any real benefit. It kind of struck me from that pharma and healthcare comms professionals face some quite unique challenges when it comes to trust and communicating with their audiences. Ordinarily, people sort of choose which brands they buy from and engage with. So there's already an established relationship and some kind of positive rapport, whereas pharma's trying to reach practically everyone with something like a vaccination program. And some people are really sceptical of that and reluctant to engage.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that came across a few times, really. I mean, definitely those kind of challenges and mis and disinformation was a huge thing. I'll talk about that in a sec, actually. But I really thought it was a general theme of kind of collaboration and sort of the urgent need for it. And I know maybe this is a bit soft and obvious, but I really felt that it was a sort of constant thing that pharma companies really desperately want to engage with health bodies, with sort of public sector and, you know, with each other where they can and really sort of, you know, work together towards all of these goals. And as I say, maybe that's an obvious thing to say and maybe they would say that every year. I really got that feeling from the conference that, you know, we need to work together with all of these challenges. And, you know, one of those biggest challenges, of course, is AI. Back to AI.
Our favourite topic.
Yeah. I mean, there was a really good panel at the end of the day that you chaired, Siobhan, on AI.
I did.
And there were some really strong warnings about mis and disinformation. We've heard similar warnings before, but the words from Healthcare Communications Association CEO Mike Dixon, particularly strong, I thought. He spoke of the dangers of big AI, in quotes, saying, I think we're going to see a general, real, sudden understanding of how dark AI can be. What happens in the longer term is how we respond to that. Talking about the amount of fake and doctored sort of images and videos around sort of election time. And obviously the issue of AI and fakery is no more important than in the pharma world and healthcare, because, you know, that will be an area where sort of fake news kind of seems to live and thrive, unfortunately.
We saw it during COVID, didn't we, on a minor scale, maybe on some of the misinformation and disinformation that came from that.
Yeah. Well, it was pointed out last year, I might have even been at the PR360 actually, when someone made the point that if we had COVID again in the time when AI is what it is now, that it would be just off the charts how much fakery would be around. So, you know, once again, massive challenge for the industry, but also massive opportunity to sort of place yourself at the sort of vanguard of combating this. And on that point, another interesting argument made on the panel was from Lisa Timothy, who's External Affairs Director at Takeda. She's saying that it's often the comms people are expected to bring the rest of their organisations up to speed on these issues. So she put it, there isn't anyone really that can tell us in communications and public affairs how we should use it. This is up to us. So yeah, big challenge. But also, you know, given the rise of AI and the rise of these problems around mis and disinformation, it's a really golden opportunity for the industry to make itself totally invaluable and absolutely crucial to organisations. So, you know, if I'm going to be half glass full with all this stuff, I feel that's where we should think of it, really. What do you think?
No, I agree. And I think, as you say, especially if we're looking at pharma and healthcare comms, some of the best sort of campaigns we've seen that have been around those subjects have used some really good influence and really strong influence to get that message across. So I think, as you say, going back to that collaboration, that's how it works to sort of maybe combat some of this, is making sure that you're using a really good advocate, especially maybe influencer marketing, that's really going to work for your brand and your comms. But Lisa also was, when she was talking about the being the people that are being the experts, I think it was because I'd asked her about training as well and sort of saying, do you think that comms agencies should be hiring people from the world of AI into being experts? And she was sort of saying, no, I think it's sort of everyone's job really as well to be trained on that, which I thought was a really strong point as well, because we're sort of seeing a mixture of both across the sector at the moment, that they're hiring experts, but then some announcing that they're training their entire staff on it. As you say, I think it's one of these that the industry needs to become a leader on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're right. It's sort of, it can't be solely one thing.
No.
Because I think the worst thing that can happen is, you know, you make a couple of marquee signings of AI experts and then think, right, well, that's done. These people can just sort out
AI. Tick the box on that one.
Yeah. It's a bit like creativity. You know, I think there was maybe a sense a decade ago, a few agencies may have been tempted to think, well, we'll get a creative director in and then that's sort of solved our creativity. They can just sort of lead on that. But, you know, it's not quite as simple as that. Although I do think having that expertise is really important.
Absolutely.
But whether that's via direct hires or whether that's by sort of training schedules or investing in specific tools, sort of bespoke tools and that sort of thing, I'm not entirely sure. I guess there's more than one way to do it. But yeah, what a challenge.
Absolutely. That's all the time we have today. Thanks to John and Evie for sharing your thoughts and insights. Before we go, I'm going to do another plug. Sorry, guys. The PR Week UK Awards, that's our biggest awards event of the year, is now open for entry, so don't miss out. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, then we'd love it if you could leave a review, please, wherever you access PR Week's Noise in Brief podcast. This podcast goes live every 2 weeks, but look out for our longer interview-based podcast, Beyond the Noise, which comes out next week. Thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.